RunAsRadio.com. You're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 107 with guest Robert Smith, recorded Thursday, April 16th, 2009. Run As Radio is produced each week by Quap Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow the boys on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
This is Richard Campbell. You're listening to Run As Radio. With me, as always, my co-host, Greg Hughes.
That's me. Hey, Richard.
How are you, sir?
Good. How about yourself?
Oh, you know, going like crazy and getting ready for Tech Ed. Things are exciting as usual. And we still got the sweepstakes going on over at .NETRocks.com.
Right.
The .NET Rocks folks, and I'm one of them, we're giving away a free pass to Tech Ed, airfare, hotel, and a pass for one lucky winner. All you got to do is enter the sweepstakes.
Pretty cool deal.
Yep. Swing over there and have a look at what we're doing. But let's dive right into this, because, you know, I always know we're having a great show when the conversation basically starts even before we're recording. We've got Robert Smith with us, and Robert, you're one of the premier field engineers, and I don't think enough folks know about PFEs.
Okay, and you want me to kind of talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. Just dive right in. We've talked to Clint Huffman and a couple of other premier field engineers, so just tell us about your role. You know, what is it you do?
Okay, I want to start by, you know, saying thank you for having me on the program. It's very, very informative, and I've listened to several episodes. But anyway,
thanks.
PFE, Premier Field Engineers, we're a group of, we do support and consulting for Microsoft. We fall under the customer service and support umbrella, which, you know, encompasses, it used to be called PSS, and now it's called CSS and Premier. But we do the same type of thing. We work closely with customers, often geographically. And we try to build a relationship and you know, go to the, you know, often go to the customer site every day and spend time and build this relationship. And so we know the customer, we know what they're trying to do, what they would like to do in the future, and we do everything possible to facilitate success, you know, in whatever their venture is.
So which customers do you work with, or what's the relationship of the type of customer, and how do they usually engage you?
I work with Lockheed Martin. Mostly. I've been also working with a relatively new customer called United Launch Alliance, and they actually are rocket business, and they're a new company that was formed from the rocket business from Boeing and Lockheed Martin, and they're now standalone entity. And so they have a big facility right in Denver, and I go and consult with them. But also I go and work with Lockheed. Sometimes I have to travel because Lockheed is spread all over the place.
Sure, scattered
everywhere. East Coast, West Coast, whatever. But generally, you know, we have a pretty good presence out here in Denver.
So is it generally big companies like Lockmart that have PFE relationships?
Generally, yes. The you know, the contracts are a certain size before they're signed. You know, we don't just take, you know, the smaller contracts, and it's not that it's some great expense. It's just that we have a threshold because we allocate headcount based on, you know, the hours that we sell. So, you know, we try to, you know, sign a certain size contract and say, okay, this is your person. You know, I'm dedicated to Lockheed Martin. And there are others that are dedicated to Lockheed Martin. So that's my job, is just to go in there and build the relationship. And, you know, if sometimes it's reactive, sometimes I'll walk in there and they're having a crit set or something, but
sure.
And that's kind of why I got, you know, pointed in the direction of Run As Radio, is because I spend a lot of time troubleshooting storage performance, and we thought it'd be a good topic to bring up.
Well, absolutely, and I think a lot of folks are surprised and frustrated with their storage systems. You know, the vendors tell one story, and people's experiences tend to be somewhat different, and there's lots of reasons why. It just turns out more complicated than people really think.
Yeah, it turns out that, I don't know, storage, in managing storage technologies, you know, is pretty intensive, and it takes a lot of, you know, you have to keep up with, you know, evolving technologies, and a lot of it is not really quite as automated as it should be.
Right.
A lot of the things, maybe they don't work the way they do at the trade show, simply because the environment's not the same. It's not that the product doesn't do what it says it's going to do. It's just that you get into the environment and things are different, you know, and you have different requirements. And so it, to me, you know, I think we're still evolving and, we've made a lot of progress. There's no doubt about that. And I've seen some great things, you know, solid state, SSD. That's going to be great because then hopefully at some point we can start doing away with this term called spindles, you know, and this, to me, kind of almost antique.
Yeah, it is technology. A little archaic. Sure. It's like vinyl records.
Vinyl records are great, you know, but they have their place, you know, and you just have all these complex problems that arise because of, you know, allocating spindles, and it's just very complicated.
Now, I've been paying close attention to the SSDs situation, and this may be a bit of a digression from our topic, but it's obviously something that's near and dear to your heart, too. We're not seeing a lot of traction on SSDs on the enterprise level. It seems like it's a desktop product so far.
SSD is expensive. The last I heard, it was, what is it, like $100 a gigabyte or so.
Right.
So for the mainstream enterprise customer, it's just not, it's not cost-effective, and there was... At some point, I think they were talking about hybrid storage where it's partially SSD and partially spindles, you know, spinning platters. But
right.
the spinning platters have evolved so much, and they're so high-performing now that they're just still cost-effective to run those things, you know. And that's where we're at right now. We have to, you know, our storage performance problems, a lot of them arise because of and I wanted to mention this, everything, it seems like everything we do in storage is a trade-off. Of some kind or another.
Sure.
We have a disk drive that, you know, the vendors want you to get a 300 gig or a 600 gig. But, you know, if your cost model is based on gigabytes, then you're not going to get the performance.
Right.
Because, you know, your spindle is, you have one spindle that does 300 gigs, and maybe your budget says, well, you guys just need a terabyte, so you just need three drives. Really, we need 6 or 8 or 10. To meet the performance requirements. So that's, you know, there's always a trade-off.
You know, if you think back long enough, I can remember when it was, you know, I mean, $100 a megabyte was a big deal. And, you know, the idea of a gigabyte was so far off in the future and seems so unrealistic to so many of us. But, you know, that's where we are now. You know, gigabytes are super, super cheap. So the world has changed. The question that I have too about the SSD stuff is just like mean time to failure. How many times are we going to be able to read and write to this stuff before it just doesn't work anymore?
That's one of the big problems that everybody's working on, because it's true that the cycle, the duty cycle, is not the same. There's even right. APIs in Windows that are being developed, and I'm not, you know, of course, I'm not revealing any big secrets or anything, but, you know, there's APIs that are being developed to change the way that we write to the disk so that we don't, you know, sit there and write any more than we have to. Just to help improve the life, the duty cycle, the SSD.
Yeah, well, and if I'm part of the challenge of the SSDs, we've seen this in IBM X25 research. There's been a big kerfuffle around this, that they know these cells only last so long, so they're constantly rewriting things to make sure that the writes are even across all the cells, and that's becoming part of the problem of longevity as well. There's just so much chatter on these drives to try and keep them balanced.
True. You know, one of the things, because I go to the trade shows once in a while, and one of the things that I saw was pretty neat is, you know, you're running, I don't know how many terabytes, you know, 16, 32 terabytes, and you're running it using like 80 watts of power.
Right.
Yeah.
You can zero every cell in the entire array in 5 seconds. So there's some amazing potential out there, you know, and then the IOPS, you know, and I don't want to get too, you know, start using lingo without saying what an IOP is. It's simply an input-output operation per second, a disk transfer operation. So these SSD devices, some of them are doing, you know, what, 100,000 IOPs. You know, it could be any kind, read, write, random, sequential, doesn't matter. And so, you know, the future looks really good. But, you know, today, you know, and that's kind of why I'm talking today about storage performance is, we're still bound to these problems that we have based on spindles.
Yeah, the
spinning platters.
Yeah, the number of right. platters and the number of heads, all of these things matter. I've definitely just gone through this with a customer where the reality came down to too many apps competing for the same spindles at the same time, and the disk queues just blew out the window. And that's what was killing them, and they just had never looked at their application that way before.
Right, and... See, that's a whole problem that you get into with, especially on storage area networks or SAN.
Right.
Is that because of, you know, disk pooling or disk virtualization or conglomeration, whatever the term is, where you group together disks, because of the resulting amount of gigabytes, you might have to, you know, share those.
Yes.
You might have to, you know, carve up those, and they call them LUNs, but it's really just a logical disk device. And you pass those out to different people. And the servers, you know, one server might get busy doing something really disk intensive, and it makes another one suffer.
Yep.
Because they're sharing the same spindles in the back end. And that's really, really hard to troubleshoot sometimes.
Well, and I think that's part of the problem is that SANs make that process more opaque.
Right. That's the nirvana of SAN is that, well, now you can, you know, more efficiently utilize your storage. You know, and they'll tell you that captive storage, which is, you know, storage that's tied to servers, you know, the utilization is low, 10 to 15%. So you have a lot of wasted storage. So on a SAN, we can make up for that. We can pool and present and reallocate and do lots of things, but there's still problems that are out there that are having to be addressed.
Yeah.
Some people try to address those by using, you know, the old method of where, okay, I'm just going to manually create my group, my disk group, and I'm going to give it to a server so I'll have better knowledge of what's on the back end.
Right.
So how do folks go about actually instrumenting their storage infrastructure, knowing that, just finding out that this is the problem? I know my app's running too slow. I've got the complaints. How do I get started in saying this is where the problem lies?
From a Windows perspective, we really don't have too much visibility into this. Let's say it's a SAN. Okay, we could have direct attach, but for right now, we'll say it's a SAN.
Right.
So we don't know what's going on. SAN is just a transport. So I'd say we start with perf performance monitor, perfmon, and we'll look at things like, you know, we'll start with disk transfers per second. How many IOPS am I doing? What is my response time? And how many IOs am I building up in my queue? And the queue is simply an IO that's waiting to be serviced.
Mm-hmm.
There's a trade-off, you know, like I said, everything's a trade-off. We have to try to keep the queue as full as possible without making IO wait excessively. So, you know, we go back to the spindle and you say, well, a fiber channel spindle is capable of doing about, on average, about 3 IOPS or IO operations per second. Other drives, you know, maybe like a SATA, S-A-T-A drive might be 2. So therefore, if you have a disk group that's comprised of 5 disks, you might say, well, the queue length should be around 15. Now, nothing is static in the computer world. Things are going to spike and they're going to go up and down. So these ephemeral or these short-lived spikes, we don't worry too much about those as long as the storage can recover. We look at sort of averages over time and make sure that we're not making IO wait excessively. And perfmon is a great tool for that. There's other tools. There is a tool called Server Performance Advisor. It's a free download. It's really meant for Server 2003. I think you can use it on Windows 2000, but not, hopefully we're getting away from Windows 2000 by now. And it uses a combination of event tracing for Windows and perfmon counters to provide you just almost a report based, you know, here's what your load is and here's your response.
So it all gets back to perfmon, right? Everything we ever wanted to know about our system is in perfmon. We just can't find it.
Yeah, it takes a while to get, you know, to get accustomed to know what you're looking for in perfmon. And the thing about storage, you know, if you're troubleshooting storage, you want to make sure that your sample interval is sufficient, that you're not losing a lot of what's happening. In other words, you know, if you set your interval at 5 minutes or even 30 seconds,
right,
that's too long. When I do storage troubleshooting, I'll say, okay, let's capture physical disk and logical disk at a 1 second interval and nothing else.
Yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't the testing now become part of the data set?
You mean the overhead of sampling?
Yeah.
It's mostly in memory. I mean, it's not, you know, you're ticking the drive every so often, but it's not really disk intensive. There's very little overhead. It's not enough to skew the results too much.
Okay. But I mean, it's interesting to know. Where would you be writing this out to? Do you just keep it in memory? Are you actually trying to log it to disk or log it to SQL Server or something like that?
Well, you can log it to disk, you know, and you can capture from another machine over the network interface.
Yeah. That was, I was thinking that the thing to do is to, especially when you're analyzing storage performance, is to ship it off to another machine so that your writes to the disk aren't impacting your record keeping.
Yeah, that's a very good point. You're absolutely right. And that's why we, you know, we'll say, let's do it over the network. So it's pretty much mostly handled in memory and then through the network interface. Not too much goes to disk in that scenario. And so you capture from another machine, you know, you do your analysis. You can automate the whole thing with Logman, which is a tool that's built into Windows. I do want to mention another tool, though. Perfmon is and has been, you know, probably the greatest tool. But there's a new one that's been around for a little while. It's based on event tracing for Windows.
Oh, yeah.
And it's called the Windows Performance Toolkit. It's another free download. And actually, I believe the latest version is in the software development kit, the SDK. Which, you know, that can be a big download, but there's a lot of good information and tools in there. So that's, you can download that. Now you've got the Windows Performance Toolkit. Now you have to install it on Vista or Server 2008. However, you can copy, there's two files that you can copy to a Server 2003 machine. It's xperf.exe and perfctrl.dll. Those two files. And this is all documented on the blog, so you don't have to, it's the Windows Performance Toolkit blog. You don't have to remember all this right now, but anyway, you copy those two binaries to Server 2003, and now you can collect traces from a Server 2003 machine, and then you have to copy the trace over to the Vista or 2008. But it's just amazing the information that you'll get from this. You can see a visual of where on the volume the I/O is taking place. You'll reveal things you didn't know were happening. What if you have concurrent I/O operations, like two intense data streams at the same time? Well, a lot of your delay might be simply latency from the seeking that's going back and forth. And you see that visually in the XPerf tool. And you also see every single I/O. So, you know, here you wouldn't capture for a long time. You might capture for 5 minutes.
Right.
Because the files can get really big. The great thing about XPerf, though, is it's all in memory and kernel mode, and you can start and stop a trace without any kind of reboot. There's no disruption to the server.
Well, and what's interesting, just looking over Performance Analyzer and so forth in the WPT here, is this is aimed at performance tuning. So it feels like it's Perfmon data. They've just stripped away the stuff that isn't related to performance.
Yeah, and event tracing for Windows, I mean, that's a whole topic you could go on for a long time. I mean, because you can trace CPU activity, power states. It's just amazing. But as far as storage performance, it reveals things like, for example, with cluster, I can see all the cluster I/O that you wouldn't see that in Perfmon because it's more of a SCSI command than it is, you know, a read or a write. And I can see flush I/O, which would come from the volume shadow copy service that I may not see in Perfmon.
Right. And this all comes down to just trying to get a picture of where the performance problem lies, like that you are hammering a driver, that this particular spindles are too busy. My question then is, what does this failure mode look like? How do you tell that that's the problem?
When it's storage?
Yeah.
Generally, you start with response time. Okay, you start saying, well, my response times are bad. What could it be? So let's start with the storage. And we will, you know, I like to go right first into the Windows Performance Toolkit. I wish I could show you, but one of the things that you'll see is you get almost like an Excel spreadsheet type view of every single I/O. Two of the columns, one of them is, the time that the I/O spent from beginning to end. In other words, from the time it was built till the time it was marked complete. There's also another queuing counter that measures the time that I/O left disk.sys, which is the very last component in Windows, till the time it was completed. So the difference between those two counters will show you how long that I/O spent queued up waiting to be serviced. That will give you an idea of whether your latency looks like it's coming from the storage or if it's in Windows itself.
Right.
You know, maybe I've seen a lot of cases where MySQL server, which is really tough on storage sometimes, can really batch up the I/O. I mean, it's just like getting a bucket of water and just pour it all at once.
And so the LUN doesn't have the ability to service the number of requests it's getting all at once, and the disk queues just pile up.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Even though in most cases, in many cases, we're talking to cache.
Right.
You know, we have this big, huge cache in front of the spindles that helps optimize, and they do to some degree, but, you know, depending on the workload, you get pretty random. You can actually use up that cache pretty quick.
Well, and you get these sort of states of cache meltdown where we're now, you know, we're actually out of memory again with SQL Server, shocker, and there's not enough stuff can stay in the cache to give a good overall performance on certain tasks. So you got such disparate tasks competing for that cache that each thing has half the stuff needed to be cached. And for me, it's always been when I know I have a storage problem when I go and look at, I got lots of disk queuing. Disk queuing is my red flag. Now I know I should pay more attention to disk. Is there any reason that a long disk queue is good?
If your disk queue is too high over time, then that generally means that the disks can't keep up with the load that you presented them.
Right.
In other words, I kind of alluded earlier the rule of 2 or 3 I/O per spindle, as it were. Sometimes, now here's a whole other problem. You may not know how many spindles are back there.
Right.
What if you have a storage device that likes to pool storage and then just, you know, allocate LUNs? So you get to the point where maybe you do go to the Windows Performance Toolkit to look at the queuing and see, well, whether it's the I/O, where is it waiting? Is the disk service time look good? In other words, by the time I let go of that ERP, the I/O request packet from disk.sys driver, till the time it was completed. In other words, that's a calculated measurement of how well the storage is doing.
Right.
You know, so that's one indication right there of if it's a storage problem. Interestingly enough, there's another place you can go look if you happen to have, I don't know if I should mention names, you know, vendor names, but Emulex in their utility, and I'm sure QLogic has somewhere, but there's a counter that you can look at. It's called FBSY, and that means Fabric Busy. There's another one called PBSY, Port Busy. And if those counters are non-zero, or the number in there is non-zero, then you're likely stalling somewhere out on the SAN. So you're actually overrunning a port somewhere on the SAN. So that's just another tool to help you troubleshoot, you know, where is this slowdown happening?
This is querying the HBA, or what is it that you're talking to here when you're getting this information?
PBusy or FBusy is a response from the fabric, from a fabric port somewhere.
Oh, okay.
It could be in the switch, you know, if you have a fiber channel switch.
Sure.
Or if you have, you know, the fabric port on the storage device itself. Somewhere there, some device is returning this response. So that's a fiber channel thing.
Okay.
SCSI or iSCSI technology may return busy, you know, a SCSI response. So that's just some places you can look for more information.
Now, Robert, isn't the correct answer to this problem every time more spindles?
No, that's the first thing are like, let's just add more spindles. It's not always. Sometimes it can be a matter of changing your cache settings on your controller. You know, maybe because SQL tries to cache a lot of reading in memory on the server itself, maybe we can allocate some cache more towards writing. There's some other things we could do. We look at things like partition alignment. How is my partition aligned on my RAID disk? Now, what that means is the clusters are lined up with the elements of the RAID storage. You know, so we call them chunks, or we call them elements, or
right,
stripe units. And if we cross a boundary of a stripe unit with a partition allocation, then we incur a 2x performance hit. So we have delays by having misaligned partition. Very simple to fix. The problem is you have to do it when you create the partition. You can't do it after the fact. So either use Server 2008, which aligns every time, or use disk part, and you do it manually. Align equals 1024.
And yeah, what does an aligned partition look like? Are we talking about like the 64K block size that SQL Server likes so much?
Yeah, it's the starting offset. The partition starting offset, is it lined up either, it used to be called cylinder aligned, I believe. So it started off at like sector 63. And if you happen to look in your, whatever tool you're looking at, like MS Info 32, you see that your partition starts on sector 63. That doesn't divide evenly by any RAID element there is. So you know right off the bat that's misaligned. A lot of vendors will tell you, 128. That's okay because that lines up. And when we say, what's that number mean, 128? So that's the starting offset for that partition. Offset from, let's say, zero, sector zero on a disk. So we go out 128 blocks and we'll start the partition. And that happens to line up with the 64 kilobyte chunks that are pretty common in the enterprise storage.
Sure. So by doing this and by optimizing it, at the storage level that way, we're really offloading the work that would otherwise have to be done by the operating system in terms of and the subsystems to compensate for the fact that it's not set up that way.
What happens if you have a misaligned partition is you might seek to a certain block on the partition, and to fulfill that I/O might incur two accesses to the disk where it otherwise would only have taken one because we cross a RAID element boundary. And so we've measured, there's been people at Microsoft and other places that have measured up to a 30% performance hit right there. So this is when you're building your partition align every time, that's just a very simple thing you can do. You can script it if you want, and you'll save yourself a little headache by not having to worry. You can worry about something else later.
But you do have to do ahead of time. So
You have to do it ahead of time.
And like you said, SQL 2008 does this by default now.
Windows 2008 does it by default, yes.
Right, sorry. Yeah, this is a Windows 2008 thing, not SQL.
Windows Server 2008, right. Yes. For most disks, it will start the partition at a 2048 sector offset. There's a KB article out there that explains this pretty well, and it's pretty easy to find in your favorite search engine. And if not, I can follow up because I can't remember the number just off the top.
I understand, and it's just one of those very odd things that I wonder how many people listening are like, I knew nothing about this. You're telling me literally cutting my performance in half if I get this wrong, and I've never looked at it.
This is true, and that's part of that is because of backwards compatibility with the old, it's called cylinder heads and sector.
Right.
Geometry of older, because disks don't use that anymore. They just don't. Everything's abstracted. It's all about sectors now. The hardware on the disk handles all that, so there's no such thing really anymore as cylinders, heads, and sectors. Windows, for the longest time, trying to be backwards compatible, would create, when you create a partition in the GUI, in the UI, it would, misalign right off the bat. So this is one of those free things you can do and pick up some performance right there if you're not doing it already.
So that's one really great proactive thing. I mean, it sounds like that's something that could impact a lot of people potentially. Are there one or two others that you run up against all the time that if people were to be proactive, plan ahead, or do something, that they would solve a lot of the problems that you typically have to deal with?
Keep up with your drivers. In Windows, if you're using, let's say you're using direct attach, let's start with the simplest things. Still, keep up with your drivers and firmware. SCSI port.sys. Now, and store port.sys, those are Microsoft technologies for the storage port driver.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Microsoft, the thing about the way that we do business, we don't generally proactively notify people when there's a hotfix. We'll say, well, wait for the next service pack. Well, sometimes you can pick up a little performance just by updating, store port or SCSI port. And then at the same time, look at your mass storage drivers. Go ahead and update those. Check the firmware. Now when you start talking about SAN, and when I say SAN, I want to include iSCSI and Fibre Channel in the same context, even though a lot of people think of them differently. With Fibre Channel, you can look at your QDEP settings on your HBAs. Now, this is another one of these areas that takes a lot of, you can get yourself in trouble. You know, because you think, well, if I increase the Q depth, then I can, you know, it's just like opening the spigot on the faucet. And it's, that's true. But if you overrun your sand, then we're back where we started with the,
right.
the F busy and the P busy. In other words, the sand will return, instead of servicing your IO or passing your IO, it will just return an error and say, you'll have to wait. It's just like slamming the door shut on your IO.
Sure.
So you can tune a little bit. Just make sure that you're not, overrunning or causing, you know, slowdown because you're just over sending too many IO. On the other hand, you want to keep the spigot open far enough that you're keeping enough IO in flight that there's always one or two or three waiting to be serviced. So those are some things that you can do without, you know, those are short of, you know, having to add new disks to your array or whatever.
And in theory, I mean, you could be in a situation where you go and you, like we said, add disks to your array, just assuming that that's what your problem is, but then you could actually have a problem where you're not properly tuned in terms of how much water you're shoving down the throat of your storage system, right?
That's exactly right. You know, you think, well, I'll add some more spindles and that should solve my problem. Well, maybe that's not the problem in the first place. You know,
right.
Sure, maybe it's not a bad thing to have more spindles, but, you know, we have to make sure that we're keeping the pipe full, because if we're not, or make sure we're not overrunning the pipe and making, you know, IO wait at the gate, as it were.
Well, and like you said, it's okay to have a couple of items in the disk queue just to keep those spindles busy, and you get a sense of what that right number is. But adding more spindles isn't necessarily going to drive that down if the LUN is strangled.
This is true, yeah. And there's more, you know, there's actually more that you can do, but it actually gets pretty tough sometimes unless you have access to the storage device yourself. Because the performance monitor tool, Perfmon, our old friend, there's usually a counterpart that lives in the storage device.
Right.
Even in a fiber channel switch or mm-hmm. even iSCSI switches, you might have performance counters there too. So you can always look there if you have access. But a lot of times, a lot of cases that I run into, you have the server group, you have the SAN group. You may even have the storage group, and a lot of times those groups don't get along so well. They don't trust each other.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
It gets easy to get into the finger-pointing game. That's why we need good measurement data so that we don't point at each other. We point at the data.
That's exactly right. You're right.
It's another good reason for plan ahead and plan together. Don't throw something over the wall to the next set of people in your chain. You know, bring them in for the design phase, and you can solve a lot of those problems early on, probably.
Yeah, there's a couple other tools. There's a fiber channel information tool it's another free download from Microsoft.com, and you can actually look at there's some stats that are kept in a certain place in the HBA for fiber channel, and once in a while, I've actually solved a performance problem because I saw that there was some CRC errors building up, and we were able to point to a specific, you know, it turned out, I forget what it was, a cable or something, but there was a piece of hardware that was causing the problem. So that's just another little tool that you can throw out there. Some of those stats are in the fiber channel management tools, HB Anywhere, QLogic has SandSurfer, and there's other tools out there.
All right, Robert, we're getting down towards the end of the show here. I don't think any conversation with storage could be complete, especially while we're still living on spindles, without maybe some mention of defragmentation. Where do you stand on defrag?
Defrag is certainly an issue, and, you know, if your data gets spread out sufficiently, then there is unnecessary seek time. There are certain storage devices that will intentionally scatter, you know, like one uses this technology called WAFL, Write Anywhere File Layout.
Right.
But there is still some benefit to defragmenting. The way I look at it, though, is you got to make sure that you're not inducing more overhead to try to solve that problem. So just, you know, if there's a tool that you're using, I mean, Microsoft, you know, Windows has built in some defrag tools. You know, if you can run those during maintenance hours or off hours or something like that, that's great. Go ahead and do it. just, you know, some of the tools that I've seen are, they run services and things. Just make sure that the tools don't induce more overhead than we're, the benefit that we're getting.
Right.
You know, because the high-end storage tries to write the blocks that you throw at it. It tries to write them contiguous in the first place. So there are some optimizations that happen on the back end. So, I'd say just use it judiciously, you know, like anything else.
Absolutely. All right. I think we're about at the end of the show. Robert, any final shout outs, things people should be looking at?
Just keep up, look at SSD. I think it's going to be the future. Holler at your storage vendors, holler at Microsoft. If there's something you want fixed, please speak up and let people know, because if you don't, then we won't know what you want fixed. And the more voices, the better.
And I'll make sure to throw a link up on the website for the Windows Performance Toolkit. It looks like a great tool for digging into these sorts of problems.
I love it. You know, it was silent for a while. It wasn't released to the public, and then finally it was released, and then a lot of people love that tool.
Excellent. Robert Smith, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.